This is Viewpoint Vancouver, and I'm Gord Price. This is a special Viewpoint podcast, special because it's live, well, live people, that is, at my soiree held in my living room after the pandemic, to hear something very special, author Colin Stein and his new book, In Conversation. Now, got to say, Colin has been very active in Viewpoint, present at the creation practically, and plays a role still. But this book, and I'm going to tell you, it is extraordinary for what it documents. It's Van Bikes, Vancouver's Bicycle People and the Fight for Transportation Change, from 1986 to 2011. Really an oral history, but in some cases, this reads like a page-turning novel. I kid you not. It is a very good read. And with Colin, we're going to explore not only what it's about, but some of the people that he wrote with and about are actually in the room. It makes it special. This is Viewpoint Vancouver. We're back again. And best of all, we're back with Colin Stein, who's written really what I would say is a kind of epic story about our time and place. I exaggerate only slightly. But let's find out first, Colin, where are you from? And what brought you out here? And did you find what you came out for?
Well, good questions. I'm from Toronto. Born in 72, so when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was actually North York, one of the five boroughs, I believe, although they were separate municipalities. It was an amalgamated city.
You're a suburban boy.
Suburban boy. You've written a little bit about the Grand Bargain, which I participated in. Nothing uncommon. House.
Single-family house.
Single-family house. Two parents, mom, dad, two older brothers. Walkable to schools, actually all three of my schools growing up. Access to buses. I mean, in Toronto, the TTC, pretty solid. Got me everywhere I wanted to go, which was really only often outside of the suburbs to downtown.
You were leading the suburban good life? Did it seem like that at the time?
It didn't seem like anything out of the ordinary. Didn't everybody live like that? I think if you had asked me at the time, I used this line once actually recently, was, I didn't encounter any difficulties. Nothing challenging was asked of me. Nothing was demanded of me. And I had everything I wanted growing up.
Is that the reason why you wanted to leave?
Well, funny you should say. I don't know. Maybe here's the thing. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, because I was very much, and this will come up a few times. In fact, this may flummox your questions of me about ideas of policy and advocacy, the core stuff that others have done. I'm more of a creative person. I'm a creative type. So I went to art school. I spent a lot of time writing, doing cartoons, two older brothers. So I wasn't in the fray of a lot of the household stuff. I was on my own, able to sit at my little table and do my own thing.
This creative thing, does that automatically mean you want to go west in Canada?
It meant that, I mean, we're skipping ahead a little bit, because what I had to do was realize that I needed to find what is the role for someone in as you grow up, as you get into academics, serious academics, and a career. Well, do you stick with the creative direction, or do you find some more practical things to do with yourself, try and learn some things, and try and get a job? I never thought that being a starving artist or going in that direction would be an option. It was something, though, that really grounded me in life, and I had some strong influences in that world.
All right, this job you speak of.
I had no thoughts about it. Look, I went to Queen's University. I got a general arts degree. And aside from sociology maybe being somewhat relevant in my life today, group behavior, larger, broader population level dynamics, fine. But I never did a master's. I never did anything really that practical. But where I got, I think, the next level skills that I could bring to the working world was my extracurricular work. I actually spent a lot of time with engineers. I was voted an honorary member of the Engineering Society by virtue of my 3 years working for the Engineering Society newspaper, publishing one. So I was the artsy, hanging out with the engineers. And when it came time to create
The artsy guy hanging out with the engineers.
Yeah.
That often doesn't go in the same sentence.
It's how people would have defined me at the time. It was my life for about 4 years.
All right. Yeah. Why West Coast?
It wasn't the East Coast. That's why. To call it the coast, of course, it's a misnomer. It wasn't Toronto.
Our apologies to anyone listening from the East Coast.
Well, and it's about where you're from also. I needed something new. I left Toronto. I basically lived in Kingston, Ontario for 4 years. I spent the summers there too. I found my place. I found my world, my people. And I wanted to kind of keep the party going. Going back to Toronto would have meant, well, let's put it this way. I visited Vancouver in the summer of 94. So Commonwealth Games. It was a beautiful summer. In the city. And then visited a friend's cabin in Princeton. It's BC.
Oh, yeah.
It's not Toronto.
We all experienced that.
Yeah. So, you know. But you grew up in BC. I didn't know anything different. But then I realized what I'd been missing.
So it took one nice summer, and bang, out you come.
And also being forced to make a choice. Again, Toronto, Ottawa, I don't know, Halifax. Like, the choice is when you put Vancouver in the mix.
All right, so summer.
What was I looking for, you said?
Yeah, you had to get through West Coast winters. Okay, yes, I know. Poor us.
Well, no.
It can be really very depressing.
But I'm lucky in that I'm not seasonal affected in the slightest. So I didn't notice it. I came out in October.
Okay.
And I got a job. Marketing. This is what a creative person in the 90s does. There's a lot of analog basis to that. Cut and paste and, you know, paper and markers and things like that. Physical stuff. But I was able to somehow, I don't know how, make a transition to the digital world. The Canucks and the Grizzlies. I got involved with the sports teams here. It was a great entry point. It was easy. There were jobs. I paid $700 a month in rent to live. You know that Thai place on Cornwall opposite Kids Beach? It was a pizza place at the time. I lived above that.
Across the street.
Across the street from Kids Beach. In fact, at the time it was $400 a month. Isn't that crazy?
Wow, the golden age.
Yeah. So I stuck. And I met my future wife at Orca Bay. And zoom on into land of real estate, got an early lucky kids, never part of the plan, happened. I'm forever changed in the best of ways from that. Life happened. Did I find what I was looking? I didn't know what I was looking for. It found me.
Mm. You know, we're going to have to make a... Well, you take us there. You just did a couple of hundred pages, incredible detail, on cycling activism in Vancouver. How do you get from where you were? Happy, contented kids boy.
Well, we're talking about work, the world of work. Happy and contented in a lot of ways, but I still hadn't... So you can do marketing as a creative person and get a lot of technical skills. You can get a sense of strategy. In fact, it's a great distraction because you end up in any... If you're with a company, you get to know the product people, the sales people, the operations people, and HR, and tech, and you engineers again back there. Like, you get to meet a wide variety of people, make a lot of connections, your internal clients, so to speak. So you can keep busy. But after about 15 or so years of that, you start realizing none of this is about what I want. You're a service provider internally, or if you're consulting, you do external clients, but you're promoting someone else's service or product. And at times, I was promoting stuff I didn't care about in the slightest. In fact, it starts to bother you if you are in opposition to it. Software for military and defense sector, not a great fit, and just random stuff. So there's lots of work, but do you care? I care. It turns out what I discovered is I wanted to care about the work I was doing, and I didn't always want to be the marketing person. I wanted to delve in the realm of ideas.
Do you think if you'd stayed in Toronto that you would still feel that? Or is the transition you went through something characteristically of Vancouver and the West Coast?
I think we'd have to get into my own personal psychology
to
answer that. Well, I think there's a little bit of me being the youngest of three, being interested in the world of quiet ideas, stuff that, you know, you'd have to sort of meander along, find your way. It's not great to have... to be on task every day, Monday to Friday, 5 days, constantly on someone else's agenda. I needed time to explore. And so over the years, what I realized was for the kind of person I am, for the experiences I've had in life, I needed time to become disillusioned enough to need to fight to find essentially values-based work.
The great virtue of the book that you've written is the incredible detail, all of the different lenses that you put on this story. And the great criticism of it, if I call it criticism, is going to be, who cares about this much? You've explored somehow this incredible niche at a certain time in a certain place, but was it simply your need to follow something and find out what this was about in the detail that you ultimately produced? Is that what was, what you were looking for?
Sure. Yes, but I wouldn't have devoted this much of my life to it. To be honest, it's a matter of waiting. I wouldn't have put this much time and effort into
it if I didn't
believe there was an entire, not just a people like me and a community, but a social movement and a set of policies that connect back to city making, region building, and a sense of the people of this place of in a time that's pretty, I would say it's unique, but it's actually part of, a North America-wide movement of sorts around change in transportation. It's much bigger than just, bikes are niche. But it connects to a broader base.
Where did that come from? Why did you care about that?
Because I found myself caring about a lot of other sort of somewhat niche-y, but ending up popular subjects.
Why this one?
Because I'm in it. Because it's always been part of my life. So, growing up.
How did you get into this? Here in Vancouver at this time?
Well, growing up, I relied so much on the ability to use my feet, use my bike, use transit, that I actually never got my driver's license at the age of 16. Through my late teens, university, moved out here. I was 26, and my now former wife taught me to drive at UBC Thunderbird parking lot. There was no outward expression of "you must," because if, then kids. It was pretty obvious, like, I've got to nip this in the bud. I can do this. And I did. But before doing that, I got my first bike in Vancouver at Bike Doctor. And it was the way I scouted out real estate opportunities, the way I got to work at times, even though I was like pretty much the only person, part of my identity. And, you know, I have never wanted to give up the parts of my identity that I can identify that are, like, before I had a sense of self and knew what I wanted to do, or even who I was, there were some things I knew. And they're of the fringe, the minority. So I'm not a visible minority, and I'm heterosexual. But apart from that, being Canadian, we're in a world dominated by great world powers. Being Jewish, when you're the 1% or 2% in any community, in any society. Being a Mac user, being a bike rider. These are all like fringe. At the time, being a Mac user was a fringe thing. But this is part of my identity. So I read comic books, and you shouldn't as an adult talk about, you know, these types of childish things. But some of these things are real artistic endeavors, part of literature, part of technology, the cutting edge, part of the way we get around, not everybody, but me. This was meaningful to me.
Well, I'm wondering, I was going to say maybe this book is therapy for you.
Absolutely.
Oh, it is.
Oh, sure. Not the only thing. I felt I would, and again, I wouldn't have given this much time and effort if I didn't think there was a potential audience, not just quote unquote my people or a larger community or Vancouver, but people interested in where are we going to go in this world with transportation.
I'm giving you 30 seconds. Tell me what this book is about.
Can I spend most of it on pause?
Policy?
Pause. Thinking. It's about systems change and culture change from the bottom up. Community driven. Think of Darlene Marzari in the book and her approach with team in the 1960s. There's a resonance there.
You call it Van Bike.
Yeah.
Is it about bicycles?
Yes.
And bicycle activism?
Yes.
The way you described it, it was so much more.
That's the tip of the spear. But there's something larger about listening to the community, understanding groundswells, early adopters, and seeing how that could match up to policy. But what's gonna, like what Ken Cameron would talk about, and the work about flipping the transportation pyramid. How do you bridge that gap from the groundswell to the policy where we know we got to get there? You've got to build those middle parts from the early adopters to the, I'm getting to the labels of like, you think of the parabola. We're at one end and we got to get to the middle part.
Having read it now, you're absolutely right. It is about this process, these people, this time. But I wonder if people are going to misunderstand the book because it's called Van Bike and think it's just about bicycles.
It's a portmanteau I created because it perfectly summarized what I wanted to get across in the fewest number of letters. It's about Vancouver and it's about cycling. I figured people could put it together from there, at least guess, enough to want to flip past the cover.
Our audience, I think, it's fair to say, is interested in communities, process, politics. And so I'm going to say, as a plug for someone who's in the book, don't read it just to understand what happened to cycling and activism in this period. Read it to understand how community and process and politics works.
Yeah, but I'm a marketer and a creative person. And I try and think of what an audience might sort of latch onto visually or word-wise. And so I had to work on the catchy, the meme, but also there's a subtitle that would appeal to people who want more information.
What is that subtitle?
Transportation, Vancouver's transportation chain, no. Vancouver's Bicycle People and the Fight for Transportation Change, 1986 to 2011.
I'm going to give you a better one. It's the all-powerful bike lobby exposed. That would get a lot of readers.
You wouldn't have. That's tongue-in-cheek for you. You were questioning the cover image choice.
I was questioning the cover. Why? Yes. Better explain what the cover is.
Yeah. So it's the, you know, no smoking, red circle with a line through it. You put a bike symbol in there. No cycling.
Book's not about that.
Sure it is.
On the contrary, it's the reverse.
How do you get there?
It's more about open doors than it is about...
How do you get the doors open? First, you have to feel that they're closed to you. Anybody in this room, and by the way, so it's a live recording and there's about 20 people here or so. Anybody who's ridden a bike or anybody who's in the book or would read the book and identify it feels that sense of, I'm not wanted here when they're just trying to get from A to B. The aggression... The strange, we were just talking about detours earlier, the lack of any facility when you see written public policy and promotion from at the civic, regional, provincial level, this is what we're encouraging our citizens to do. Get on your bike. It's a great thing to do. And then you're almost killed. Now, it's what is experienced, but I also felt strongly that even when people try to make the change, advocates on the outside with organizations at Hub and BC Cycling, but as well on the inside, like yourself on council, what were you getting pushback? The pushback you were getting is embodied in many ways by that symbol.
The book documents so well how many doors got open.
True. Absolutely.
That is a far more interesting story.
That's what people need to learn, but what they feel, I believe, and I think what they spoke to, and there's people here who could speak to it, was what's represented on the cover. Now, two more points. One is, literally, that's what's on the pavement in Kitts Beach Park. And so it's an expression of what people... Okay, you're trying to get from Balsam eastbound to get to the Burrard Bridge somehow. For many, many years, you're basically told with that symbol, don't bike in here. Don't bike through here. But are you going to go on Cornwall? Is the average person going to go on Cornwall? So it's an expression of this bind. Lastly, the third point... marketers steal from everywhere. Take the best ideas and we make them our own. So it's a bit of a tip of the hat to the approach of like a Adbusters cover or a Douglas Copeland approach. And I will shamelessly steal from the best of them. Self-published, remember, I'm trying to sell books.
And for that reason, isn't it always better to have a binary or mention relationship, us and them, the fighters, the oppressors, the insiders, the outsiders?
It's got to be a good story.
But that's not, I think, what you actually detail and describe in the people themselves. What really struck me is, and so many of them are in this room, how they moved from activist to insider. How the insiders, in fact, adopted ideas and strategies from the outsiders.
Right. Right.
How they crafted something that led to, and it was done right across the spectrum, to create what we have today. But that doesn't fit your narrative.
It's not mine. Is it my narrative? It's all in there, beginning, middle, and end. I chose as an icon for the cover.
Well, not the narrative to describe what you just did.
Oh, and then you're talking about the cover again.
The book itself, I think, puts shame, in fact, to the way that you described it.
Well, except I chose to depict, again, visually, a starting point. Where do we start from? This feeling like, Jesus, no one wants me on the road like this, but I'm trying to just be a citizen. I'm trying to do something responsible. I'm trying to get from A to B, and all signs are telling me no. And then when I go sit in a committee meeting, or I'm on in the media and I read the comments later, everybody's still telling me I'm on the wrong side.
So you need the them. You need the one who's in your way, the one who won't respond, the one who's fighting against you. You always need this opposition. But in fact, I'm going to give you an example of the success that came in the early days. It's in your book, in a way I never fully appreciated. How the outsider activist, Nelson McLaughlin, worked with the guy who was actually responsible for writing the plan, Marty Posbischel. And they both understood where each of the others was coming from. And it was that combination, I think, we can ask Marty here, that made it work. You wouldn't probably have had the success if you didn't have that combination.
One part of it, I would argue strongly back to you that the words from Nelson that ring, I think, truest to me. So there's his actions, but what he still holds on to this day is a lot of the crap that he got, a lot of the negativity from all parts of the city and citizenry that he was doing something wrong, and he was on the wrong side, and he's a bad guy, for lack of a better term. And I think it's important, well, to acknowledge that, yes, so my choice to put it on, that to express that in the cover, it's my choice, it's a creative choice in some ways. But I would say that we need it for maybe marketing and dramatic license, but nobody here wants that as part of their everyday work. Everyone would love to not have that us against them narrative. Like, get rid of it.
I think you just proved that they don't, in fact, that that's what sells. That makes a good read.
A read versus the, again, are we reading something? Are we doing work? Is this advocacy or history?
There was a paragraph that jumped right out at me. Better quote it here, get it right. Let me refer to your book.
Please.
God, this book is so incredibly dense with good stuff, I gotta say. So here's Danelle Laidlaw at the time. She is
the executive director of the Bicycling Association of BC.
I remember being in a meeting, said Danelle, with the provincial government, and one of the bureaucrats said to me, "You're where the environmental movement was 10 years ago. You just have to be patient." And I said back to him, "We don't have the time to be patient. This is the time. We have to change the way people transport, etc." Right? Who was right, the bureaucrat or Danelle?
I think the bureaucrat would have been right if enough had changed substantially in transportation over the last 30 years to make that request for patience true. I just reflect back on 2020, being with the BC Cycling Coalition and talking with senior ministerial staff at the Minister of Environment, and them saying, "Really, the cycling thing, so this could really be part of a new urban transportation thing? Tell me more." So there is this desire to understand this, how cycling could play into environmental, you know, climate mitigation, all this sort of stuff, as if they were hearing it for the first time in 2020, 30 plus years after that. How long are we going to be patient with all this historical policy information wisping away and disappearing into the ether, not being carried forward, nothing being done? You co-wrote Clouds of Change. 80-some-odd recommendations, or whatever, however many recommendations. How much of that was implemented in any reasonable time frame?
Reasonable time frame. Was the bureaucrat right? Did it take 10 years?
It depends on what we're waiting for. A regional network? Can I cycle to Horseshoe Bay safely with my kids? Like, it depends on what we're talking about.
We've been around long enough to be able to make a reasonable assessment about how long things take. Is 10 years that unreasonable a time? Can I even make the case, wow, only 10 years? Are you promising we can get to where the environment movement was, that we can have some of these projects underway in only 10 years?
It's so qualitative, but all I can say again is it's kind of funny to hear that line being thrown around the environment at that time when we've seen nothing but just the hole getting deeper and deeper and deeper. So how long did we... Okay, there was much more progress made with cycling, I think, in the 10 years from that to into the 90s, when that would have been projected into. Then, yeah, we've seen the environment. But I like what Mike Harcourt said to me, which is in the book, which is, if you're going to wait for politicians to act, no offense, Gord, you're going to be waiting a long, long, long time.
That's bullshit.
It depends on what we're talking about, what kind of change we're talking about.
Oh my God, I can go into a council meeting, approve a capital plan, hundreds of millions of dollars, start the mechanics rolling. Politicians are in this remarkable position where they can go in and get things done overnight. And you're saying the usual cheap cynicism that the political process has failed us.
On a degree of change that would make a significant difference on how people move about in sufficient numbers to change the dynamic of the city in this region.
What did other politicians that you were interviewing for this book, what was their time frame? What was their perspective?
Funny, I didn't talk to too many. There were some former, not many active, if any. Gregor was active at the time. Tony Valente, not quite active at the time when we spoke. Not elected yet, I don't think. But this is not a story about... See, this is the history of advocacy. This is people, some of whom were politicians, but this is also about people working outside the political process.
Well, so it's both. That's the power of the book.
It's not only both.
You bring in so many different ways of looking at this same issue from all these different perspectives. How about Marion Orser and the role that she played?
Right. So, never a politician, never a bureaucrat. I don't know if one of the few, but I would like to assume that probably one of the few women involved in long-distance recreational road riding in the early 80s, although there was probably not a bad gender split at the time, but she, working at, you know, GF Strong, living in New Westminster, got on with this group at the... I think the Vancouver Bicycling Club and BABC, and decided, you know what, I want to help out in some way outside of my working hours, sitting on a committee, on a bicycle advisory committee, helping found the Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition, which became Hub Cycling with some of the people again in this room, and giving up her time and helping mentor others.
So many women.
Yes.
I didn't keep track, but it seemed to easily half. Of all the players, the movers and shakers were women. Why do you think that is?
It's a really good question. I don't have an answer for that, but except that Danelle, Marion, there are many that I didn't talk to, such as Frances Van Loon, Helen Warren. I could go on and on, but most of them were involved, as many of the men were, in the sport cycling, road cycling, non-competitive, but sport-based cycling. And so that was an open door.
Well, I'm thinking momentum.
Well, and then eventually then the so-called creative types.
Yeah.
But I don't think there was as much of an unanticipated weighting towards women into the later 90s. More of a, we have people of all types participating. It was especially interesting in the early 80s. But to your point, Amy Walker, Carmen Mills, woman named Joelle, and many others who got Momentum magazine started.
And executive directors, Jane Ho.
Yeah, Cahoot, Tanya Lowe. Executive directors. Yep. Chi-Ying with Best, Marion Town, Marge Mahan, Stephanie Williams.
So many.
Erin Omelin with Hub. Bonnie Fenton, very involved, yeah.
Yeah. And academics.
Kay Teske, Megan Winters. First and foremost, those two.
I was intrigued by the surprisingly critical role that they played at key times. And in fact, until I read the book, I really didn't realize some of them. I'm thinking Kay in particular. There's a wonderful point you described, do you remember? About discovering the data. What was in the data?
Well, she and Gregor Robertson, Gregor upon coming into office as mayor in 2008 and 2009, looking at the Burrard Bridge. So this would have been leading up to the third go-around with, can we get a separated lane on Burrard Bridge? Or just space, protected space. And Kay Teske on the Bicycle Advisory Committee at the time, and Gregor looking at it from council, realized, wow, we have made so many out-of-court claim settlements on near fatalities. And was there even a fatality? Maybe my memory's failing me now, but there was so much money paid out, and there was so much actual damage done to people from basically being knocked over into traffic, from the lack of separation, lack of protection from traffic, that it was like, that's it, we're done. We've got to fix this. We got to...
What do you mean we're done?
This is all the justification we need. I'm speaking now hypothetically for 13 years ago in council to finally... Well, did they even need to pass it, or was part of the, was actually part of the, from what I understand, the post-2010 Winter Games road work was to work on the both approaches of the Burrard Bridge, and then eventually something was also passed around getting the suicide prevention barriers and the sidewalks extended out.
So Kay and her team literally went through the paper, that's what they had back then, and found this stuff. That there had been these accidents, that the city was vulnerable, liable.
Well, I think it was Gregor, but making this known to the Bicycle Advisory Committee, which years before had been given the approval from council, I guess the Larry Campbell and Cope-dominated council, to now have everything related to cycling go through the BAC for review, commentary, and quote-unquote approval, not really approval.
I was just struck by the recognition of some critical data that at the senior levels of City Hall would say, no debate anymore. We're vulnerable, we're liable, we're not going to be going through whether we can justify the money. We can't not do it.
Right.
And if that data hadn't been available and presented in such a way, we'd still be fighting old battles.
Possibly.
Let me give you the example I was personally aware of. My motivation for trying an experiment on the Burrard Bridge, the first one, the failed one.
96.
Yeah. Why? Because it was a good idea? Well, sure. But there was also this capital plan money of $50 million that was going to go to widen the bridge, destroy it as really a heritage icon, and waste it on something that, if we didn't need it, well, something on that magnitude in a capital plan drives more agendas than a certain amount of activism does. And it does seem to me, and you document various cases where engineers and planners, by simply looking at what some of the underlying conditions were able to drive an agenda that bypassed the politics.
Sure.
That's powerful stuff.
And that's a form of activism within the bureaucracy.
That's kind of what I've been arguing here with you. Mm. The activism within is as important in some ways, maybe more, than the activism without.
Well, I don't know. Again, this is about degrees and qualification. Like, there's no hard data saying, well, now we know actually, you know, what advocacy doesn't make a difference, or it does to some degree. But I think, well, so I'm diving in here, but I do want to challenge that because, you know, as much as, and you're in the book saying this, and I know you'll say it again now, you're not sure that critical mass made a lick of difference, that there's really anything that
it didn't go quite that far.
Well, okay, I'm putting your words in your mouth. But there is this question as to what really did it all achieve. And I believe that whether it's critical mass, the BC Klets, red, black, and shiny, women performance art, dance, and, you know, freak bikes, people welding together all these like chopper bikes, and all this sort of cultural stuff, including Momentum magazine, and all that, was integral for broadening the base enough to bridge the gap between the politicians and the leaders and the bureaucrats, including the staff, who had these ideas that think this will be right eventually for the mainstream, but who's going to bridge to the mainstream and develop enough of the small c, small m, critical mass, popular public support for the change that needs to happen?
One couldn't have happened without the other.
You need the people on the outside ripping their hair out, pounding the table, going out on critical mass rides to get more of the word out and attract more people like them.
To do what?
To ride the damn bike paths.
No, to get the money allocated.
And that, of course.
To get the infrastructure designed.
To encourage the political will. Don't you also need to see signs of the
populace?
What if
it's already there?
How would we know?
the evidence is all around us.
You didn't, but in 86, you didn't campaign on bikes because it wasn't even part of your personal portfolio yet. So I'm going back to Wayfar to think, like, how was anybody to even know? Like, when Gavin, Steve Kisby, Richard Campbell was sitting around in 1989 developing the first protest ride idea, they didn't know that you were going to take this where it took it. Yeah, the dinosaurs, exactly. Well,
tell me about the dinosaurs.
Well, I can't tell you about the dinosaurs. I wasn't there.
But who were
you? Again, some of the people I've mentioned in the book, and now, you know, holding down responsible jobs with families and bureaucrats in their own right. But Gavin Davidson and Tamim Rad and Carmen Mills and a bunch of other people dressing up in dinosaur costumes created by Lee Henderson, the fossilosopher, say that five times fast. A form of performance art, doesn't even have to be a critical mass ride. Just you see someone riding down Union Street wearing a dinosaur costume. What is that all about? Fred Bass, former city councilor, sitting in the background. He loved it. It appealed to people unexpectedly in a way. Who would have ever thought that that'd be part of the thin edge of the wedge to broaden the mass appeal of cycling?
What did happen to those dinosaurs?
Well, one ran for mayor, T-Rex. Got a few thousand votes. It was pointed out to me that, well, thankfully, it didn't seem to be the margin of difference between NPA and COPE, 99. Well, no, NPA still got in 99 to 2002. But it was a stunt. It was to draw attention. What's the impact? We can't measure it, but
and inside those
people
dinosaurs,
loved it. Pardon me?
Inside those dinosaurs, there was Tamim and Gavin. What happened to them?
Tamim and Gavin, around the same time, both ended up at this new entity called TransLink. Both as planners. And had some impact. Tamim was there a little bit longer than Gavin, and I think it's fair to say, although Richard Campbell had his hands on it as well, at best in what became Hub, if it wasn't for Tamim, most likely we would not have the Central Valley Greenway.
From dinosaurs to designers.
Sure, dinosaurs to designers.
You know, we didn't really need to have much in the way of division between the various groups that you described. Because we had the media.
Right.
What was the role of the media back then? I guess we'd call them mainstream media now. But
I didn't include too much in the book, but I have a lot of material on it because a lot of people felt that cyclists, as this exclusive noun for people who are only on a bike, which of course I'm being facetious, but this idea, it's an easy label, and when there's some new trend of traffic backups into downtown coinciding some proximity to where there's more bikes or more bike lanes or something being proposed, blame the cyclists. And in the present day, if there's, you know, a crash, somebody killed, a car is involved, it's usually driverless. So it's the framing of the narrative to, you know, relieve root cause from the narrative so no one feels attacked, no one feels maligned, except maybe those, you know, possibly without the voice, without the influence, without the power, that blame can be shifted because, you know what, it's damn annoying. The cyclist ahead of me in traffic.
I guess today we would call them marginalized.
Yeah.
Where do you think that came from, though, particularly when I dealt with the bike lanes, Hornby Street most dramatically, well, for our...
I think this belief that it was just this threat to anybody who wanted to just be free to drive their car where they wanted to go, which is fine, without understanding the underlying benefit to businesses, to communities, to families, to everyday people. And it wasn't necessarily slow-walked enough by politicians and by staff, not out of negligence or ill intent, but just the lack of knowledge of how much groundwork was needed. And it was the early days, if not in name, then at least in force, of Hub's influence in the city. And Aaron, who's here tonight, would remember quite well. Lisa Slaykov, who's not, but featured in the book, would remember quite well the groundwork that was needed at the time in collaboration with the Downtown Vancouver Business Improvement Area, Charles Gauthier, president at the time, but in collaboration to say, look, we're going to consult with the businesses, the people who are feeling most affected and complaining and feeling like it's the end of the world. And let's help understand their issues and explain the other side.
Love the way you will pull out a character like Charles Cochin and give us the detail on the backstory in his own words often. That really makes the book come alive.
I mainly only have their words because I wasn't part of the scene until 2013.
Why do you think the attitude towards cycling changed so fast? It almost seemed relatively overnight.
In a way, there's a ripping of the Band-Aid effect. In the early days of any sort of vast change that you see on paper, having to go from one place to another and having to start with small iterative changes, the smaller the changes are, the more time you spend on them, almost the greater the outrage. But when you get to the place of then, well, now it's time to do Hornby, Dunsmuir, separated lanes, right? Burrard Bridge, Arbutus Greenway, for God's sake. Enormous. This entire, whatever it is, 9-11 kilometer path from north to south through the city. The bigger it is, if you rip the Band-Aid and stand behind it, you have staff supporting it, politicians, it's much less traumatic.
Today, you mentioned in the book, I think, the Richards, the most recent bikeway. No comment at all.
Right. That was Lon LeClaire's observation, general manager, engineering. He was shocked at the lack of
Shock.
Yeah, exactly.
Is Vancouver a unique story?
I don't know. I don't know if this is the right term. Longitudinal study. Had I looked at other cities, maybe it's not quite the right term. But I did not look at other cities, so I don't know how unique that struggle, these 25 years, the presence of advocates inside and outside. I don't know how typical that is, but I thought Vancouver's got a hell of a story. I came out of these 115 interviews, usually walking on air, because I was inspired, I was entertained, I felt like I love this person, this is a person I know now, these amazing things, it was fantastic. And the stories, the anecdotes, the ideas started knitting together. It was obvious. So by about the 20th or 30th interview, I was like, wow, this is, there's a book here.
What about elsewhere in the region?
Well, elsewhere in the region is covered, and in a way, there are byproducts of the Vancouver story, either by being directly influenced. I would assume, I don't cover Richmond, but I think about, very much anyways, but I think about the railway greenway. It's very Vancouver. It's very bold. It's an awesome protected path, north to south. But then I think Vancouver had an unfortunate influence on some other places where these were anecdotes that maybe some didn't make it into the book, but it was definitely said to me. And if not in the book process, then through my work at Hub 2013-16, where advocates say Maple Ridge and Pitt Meadows, and there's a number of stories, and I'm going to say quotes here, stories, so to speak, but part of the narrative that takes place in these other cities, especially Maple Ridge, where it just won't fly. You can't make the aggressive moves, whether it was in the 80s, 90s NPA era, or in the later Gregor Robertson and Vision era. We can't go there, they would say 5-10 years ago, and I think even now. Different pace, different language, different approaches need to be used. It's trucks and farms and industry, and it's a different mood.
They need to be patient.
Or perhaps the right person at the right time, willing to put on a bigger Band-Aid and rip it off.
Well, do you think maybe the change is now going to come from the tidal wave of money that's going to pour into climate change? We can see it already with the Americans. Hundreds of billions of dollars. Climate change has moved up to number 1, 2 on the political agenda for survival reasons. And here looks to be like something right from the beginning suggests a way forward. Cycling.
My question is, where does it come from? The federal government to the provinces, and then the provinces to the regions and the cities?
Do you care?
I do, because there's been there's an incumbent government at the federal level now 7 years, now with a majority. So they've got what you think, don't you think they have what they need to?
Maybe cycling's too small. Maybe given the stakes and given the revenues or money available.
That's not the federal, largely. If you look at Transport Canada's mandate, anything other than goods movements and mass transit at the billions of dollars level, anything other than that is not under the, is not seemingly not of interest to the feds. So if the part of the federal transfers to provinces includes just, here's a bucket for environment, let the provinces figure out what will go to transportation, what will go to, whatever, affordable housing, let them figure out the climate mitigation solutions with that bucket of money. But I do care, because the money's got to come from somewhere, and it's not been budging much from budget to budget at the provincial level down to capital infrastructure dollars for transportation.
What about the consequences of technology change? Is the bike, in a sense, as we've grown up with it, obsolete? Will there be even something called a bike when you won't really know what it is, given the application of electric motors, batteries, the way they'll be utilized, the options now, they're already emerging? So we're of that old age where, yeah, you went around on this little thing called a bicycle.
Can I just say yes? Because I think it's like when, think of maybe your first Swiss Army knife. It's got a blade, maybe one or two other things. It's now this fat, 3-inch thick, multi-tool thing with, you've got all analog, so-called, and electrified devices, one wheel, two wheel, three wheels, cycling without age, two seniors in the back, you with your kids, cargo bike, it's everything. Bring it on.
All right. What's next for you?
I've got about 80 to 90 more books to sell. But there's no limit on the PDF. E-books and e-bikes forever.
E-books and e-bikes, yeah.
I would love to say that I'm starting my second book, but strangely, there's not a lot of money in books that I've found so far. To have the freedom and control that I wanted for this form of therapy, as you put it, I self-published. I would like to write a couple more books maybe about cycling, but I also have a couple more about non-cycling topics, but I'd like to get a literary agent, see if there's a traditional path forward, but otherwise, I'm marketing.
Got an untold story that you really want to tell?
Possibly. Mm-hmm. Well, let's stick to the bikes thing. This book is about, I'm going to say about 120,000 words. There's about 500,000 words of testimony that I got, and I have some of my own ideas. So there's two books, other books in draft form, waiting for that mysterious publisher to come to me with a bag of money saying, go off for another 6 months or a year.
When I picked it up, I didn't expect that I would be so pulled in. I didn't expect it would be a page-turner. I got to admit, some of it's personal, of course. You're always interested in your own story. But yeah, no, it turned out to be a far more accessible read than I would have imagined from its description.
So imagine one other book. Thank you, by the way. But imagine now, okay, that's the history. Imagine lessons learned, lessons from Vancouver. The checklist of things that advocates, politicians, planners, and engineers could or maybe should think about.
Well, thank you for that segue. What might one of those lessons be?
Well, I think I'll go back to a lesson that I learned, and I'll credit again. Look, Aaron Omelin's here. Hope, Aaron, you ask a question. He's putting the pressure on you, but you don't have to. But a significant influence on me, because my 2+ years at Hub was working quite closely with Aaron and people like Tony Valente sitting next to her, and Colin Brander behind you, and so on and so forth. The people of Van Bikes. But one of the things Aaron and I would talk about was, we're not necessarily going to, and Chi-Ying talks about this also, Chi-Ying Ho in the book. Maybe we don't condemn or condone critical mass. but we're happy it's going on. The real table pounding now on social media, some of the nasty stuff actually, there's an underlying point to it sometimes. And if we don't have to say it, sometimes I say it for God's sake. But I mean, if there can be a breadth and a range, hopefully healthy and maybe even respectful, of tactics and approaches, we want everybody trying a little bit of everything. So the people focused on policy, great. Technical stuff, awesome. Education, culture, and then protest movement stuff, it's all needed, it's all helpful, because there's one or two people, maybe in the middle, who'll be the ones who can kind of step ahead and say, Councillor Price, let's talk, because here's what we're thinking. Here's what people seem to want.
Colin, that sounds very much like what a Canadian boy growing up in the suburbs of Toronto would say. We're glad you made it out here, though.
Thanks, Gord.
And we're glad for your book.
Cheers.
Thanks, Colin.
Thank you.
Now, I suspect, because many of the characters in your book are behind
characters.
Me. Behind?
They're real people.
Some of them are definitely characters.
Yes. Agreed.
Let's see if they've got some questions for you. Or observations.
And no pressure. Kibitzing, you know, loose chatter. Oh, Robert.
Hey. Hi. You saved two copies? Hard copies?
Got it.
Come on, you guys.
Some have not even seen it or flipped through it.
Did I mischaracterize any of you, by the way, looking at you, Marty Pospisil?
No. I think you were bang on, as you always are. But I do have a question.
Sure.
Colin. There's a lot of data that you received, and you talked about that. You had 500,000 words?
That's an estimate, but yeah.
Okay. How were you able to pare that down to something that was publishable? Like, that's a tough job.
That's amazing. That's a great question.
Right? What do you leave out? Okay. Or are you leaving stuff out for your sequel?
Well, coincidentally, yes, but how I got to that point, there were two things. One was week one of my sabbatical started in September of 2021. Mm-hmm. I had already spent a couple of years doing the interviews, most of them, and portrait photography, and collecting materials. But now I was in Portland, and starting my sabbatical, I had to leave Vancouver. Feel like to think about and write about Vancouver, and I got I guess it was about a 10-foot long roll of corkboard that I unrolled, and I started writing on it, pinning things on it, using yarn. Basically created this timeline, kind of like a serial killer tracker, or maybe the serial killer themselves.
Good analogy.
I felt a little, but actually it was great, because back to this whole thing about, you know, I was going to go on a little rant with Gord about, you know, social media, and it's all digital, it's all virtual, you don't make connections. This was a way for me to connect back to my tactile, creative past. And I was able to actually physically then see, this is where there's the clustering of bikeways, like per the stories I was told in, you know, the 90s. But to be able to then see it and see the regional planning stuff, electoral timeline, like it all kind of came together, and I was able to see certain trends. The second part of it was good advice I got from my stepbrother and his wife, Jeff and Liz, credited in the book. He's written a couple of books, my stepbrother Jeff, and he said, you know, you really, this would be something, if you do write a book, do the lessons learned, the takeaways. And I was like, oh yeah, but then I'm not writing the history. And then I realized, well, if I can put it all together as the history with the lessons learned, sort of chronologically in order, it became like this 1,000-page book. But then I can carve out the stuff that's maybe redundant to like the Burrard Bridge story. Well, the Burrard Bridge story is about a bunch of other things. Or the helmet debate is also about internal conflict within a community. And if some of that can be genericized, or some of the generic language around that can be pulled out and put over there, that was the lessons learned book. And then the personal profiles, like I think everybody should know more about Councillor Bass and Price and, you know, Kerr's background and Sophia, and we haven't spoken, but people who are, you know, have these personal histories that I think anybody reading the book would be like, I identify with that person. I had the same experience growing up. There wasn't enough space in the book, so I took that out, and that's basically 100 profiles of advocates. If you want to read two or three pages about any one person you think is fascinating, that's a whole separate book.
It's going to make a great Netflix series.
So I took out two books worth of stuff, and what was left was the history.
Tough job.
Okay, next, yes.
I first would just like say how much I appreciated the history, being someone that came in around 2009 to understand how did we get here, and this beautiful cast of characters, as we're going to say, that built up the movement and made it possible for us to get where I started and then to carry that on. And I'm curious, what was the most surprising thing to you? You worked in the bicycle advocacy movement, but then you got to talk with all these folks, and what was like, wow, I had no idea.
I think for me, I guess what I just go back to is I was really drawn into the connection to the 60s and 70s and what I thought were the formative moments around community consultation, the emergence of social planning. And to me, that's really about the Darlene Marzari, Mike Harcourt, and team, the original team. I want to call them the true team party of the 60s and 70s. That there is a through line, to me that was most fascinating, most surprising, that I could not get away from that. I couldn't dwell on it as much as I wanted to. There's more about the 70s, about how Harry Lash developed and then had to step away from his baby, the Livable Regions proposals of the 70s and the GVRD, and that there were some real nuggets there, yes, around cycling, but around transit, and that I had this belief, but again, it's this fascination that, well, we'd be a much different city. It maybe would have precluded the whole cycling movement in the start in the 80s if we'd gotten transit in the 70s, people moving. So that, I keep going back to that. And I was also then maybe surprised in some way that then and through the 80s and 90s, and even until today, as much as planning is a significant part of expressing that flipping of the pyramid and expressing those values, it has seemingly been less hands-on on the actual transformation of the street level than the engineering discipline has been. Which you would say, wow, it would have been great to have more collaboration with planning, but actually I think this prompting of the engineering group to transform and to evolve and to understand that cycling movement has been fascinating and heartwarming. And if someone like Lon McLaren now who represents all the best of that transformation, sort of excuses planning to look after other things because there's so much to look after.
Isn't that ironic? Having set the engineers up, in particular, as the insider villain, a little harsh to say villain, but not far removed, I would agree. I would think that cultural transformation within engineering is one of the most surprising and interesting parts of the book. Wouldn't you agree, Lon?
Yes.
It's a qualified yes.
And you lived it. And you saw that transformation. Yes. Well, you weren't there with Bill Curtis, so not the whole thing.
Yeah, and I guess internally, initially, everyone wanted to please the angry politicians, the Gordon Price, who was like slamming us for not building enough bike lanes. But we started hiring people. Right, that were inherently good at understanding cycling, and so that just kind of accelerated the pace. Uh-huh. And yes, the Kate Teschke stuff, the science behind it, actually brought the objective voice, which is not about politics or advocacy or anything like that. It's just saying, this is what we know.
It's very powerful.
Yeah. And so we would recommend this. And then slowly adopted into the policy. You won't build new roads without this. It's like you don't build a new road without a sidewalk. So you don't build a new road without a bike facility. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I'm jumping in here, but not to take, because I think you were right on about that, so I'm excited by this. It did strike me at the time. You were putting the new recruits, the best that was coming out of UBC, and you were giving them a mandate to be creative in a way engineers very rarely have. You were going to be setting new standards and new ways of doing things, and then we kept flooding them with money.
Well, also, engineers are, they have to apply the stamp to the design.
Yeah.
And that's a seal of design, which they're going to say it protects the public for the rest of their life, because they own that design. So they don't do it lightly. So it's a whole bunch of science that is required behind it before we would say this is a safer intersection than this intersection we had before. This is a safer bridge than the bridge we had before.
But look at the creativity that went into Seaside. You kept coming up with new solutions. Stuff that never had occurred to me. And that's a pretty rare opportunity in the world of engineering, isn't it? And you had this whole group of young guys, mostly guys, who were given more or less the mandate to do it.
Yeah, and they embraced it. Yeah.
Embraced it. Golden age. I don't think we're at all ready for what's coming.
Thank you for addressing that. I was about to ask.
Yeah, yeah. So I came back from Stockholm, Copenhagen, and Paris just a month ago. And got a little... By the way, we're doing far better than places like Copenhagen in our design. That just feels very dated now. But Paris... Oh. So during the pandemic, I detailed this in Viewpoint, Rue de Rivoli. If you haven't seen it, I really recommend it. I think it's an important piece. Rue de Rivoli is the major east-west arterial. Runs past the Louvre, City Hall. It is one of the great historic streets. And it's basically one of the only east-west arterials that runs through classical and medieval Paris. So, you know, it's a big deal. And they closed off, closed, no, wrong word. They reallocated 3/4 of that street for bikes and scooters. Well, when you see the scale of that in the location, and you realize, yes, this damn thing is full of micro-mobility. This is clearly where the future is. And ironically, you come back and you see the best that we've done, one of the best in the world, Richards, and we would think that it's obsolete. It's not going to be able to handle the differential of speeds. It's not probably going to handle the volumes. Throwing climate change and the imperative, it's coming. And what an exciting wave to be riding for the next generation. Oh, man, I want to be there. So what do you got for us? Are you ready?
Yeah, he was expecting to talk about everything here tonight.
What are you guys thinking about micromobility, electric motors, just this wave of new ideas and technology that's coming at us?
Well, we're assuming it's going to all be accepted. And so, yeah, the facilities themselves will have to just expand.
Ah.
And the example of Richards is a good one, just because, yes, it's a two-way cycling facility on one side of the street. We've always assumed that if it got too busy, we'd do one on the other side of the street, and then we'd make them two one-ways. So those two one-ways would allow passing and more volume. And yes, in the future, you could just remove all the cars altogether. Richards is a perfect example where,
if you can't tell the difference,
there's no driveways, there's no deliveries, the street, we've organized everything off the lanes. So the back alleys are the lanes.
Thank God for our lanes.
Deliver all the cars to all the park gates. So it's a simple thing to actually make those streets non-auto in the long term. But
okay,
that's a lot of pre-planning, even with the planning department, you know, determining that we will not allow driveways across the sidewalks.
Right.
You know, this was a pedestrian initiative, but in the end, it's a very smart initiative.
Will we be able to tell the difference between a bike and a car?
But you might not.
Yeah, that's my feeling.
What do you do about differential speeds?
That's the biggest danger, even on roads with cars. Right, so I mean, if you could get everyone going at the same speed, but I would assume technology would allow us to do that. I mean, I just drove from like the Okanagan to Coquihalla. It's like, that's the worst example of like trucks going so slow, and then like because they're braking or they're trying to climb, and trucks that are going a little bit faster, and the car going a little bit faster, and one going way too fast. There is all kinds of opportunity for terrible, terrible collisions. And that's the same on our facilities as well. So to the extent that you could, like shared scooters and all those devices, if you could just make them go at the same speed, the danger is gone.
Well, you can.
It's gone. I know, and this is where technology can take us, right?
Governor.
So, in fact, the e-scooter, the shared scooter thing, it doesn't exist here yet.
That's what we discovered.
They're morphing all these ideas, and they're understanding now that people are ending up in hospitals, mm-hmm. and what that means, and that's serious, it's important. And so, yeah, they're adapting their devices to say, no, the device doesn't work here, or it only goes at this speed here, and they all go at this speed here.
Where's Kay now that we need her? Mm-hmm. But look, this is what Michael and I discovered. You can control the speed of these things. Geofencing.
Yeah.
I think I told you my experience, didn't I?
In which case, it's actually better if they're shared. Like if they're not privately owned, because you actually have a lot more control over them if they're a shared facility. So if they're like shared e-scooters or whatever, you can dictate.
So I was on a Lime scooter, and it slowed down. And then speed it up. I was going by a children's playground. They had geofenced it. Likewise with parking. I was told on a little map that came up on the screen where I could park. I thought, wow, you can do this on a scooter. You can do this on a bicycle. My God, you could do it on every moving thing on the road.
And then eliminate serious injury and fatality.
Well, let's include everybody in the room. I think almost without exception, well, in part of it, give yourselves a big applause, along with mine.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Viewpoint Vancouver. We want you to join us. You can subscribe, of course. Visit viewpointvancouver.ca. And, oh, while you're there, you might want to check out our Patreon page. Cool merchandise is involved. And, you know, you can help shape the region that you want to live in by helping us at Viewpoint Vancouver. Urbanism, insight, and evolution.